Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today on the show we begin by taking a look at science. You know, scientists use what they call the scientific method as a way to answer questions in a systematic way, and that method has resulted in many, many new technologies, medicine, countless other discoveries. And to talk about science with us, once again, Bassam Shakashiri. Bassam's a UW Madison Professor Emeritus of Chemistry, former Assistant Director for Science and Engineering Education at the National Science Foundation. And it's going to be fun exploring science with him today. And I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have relating to science? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Bassam, welcome back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you for the continued opportunities to visit with you and your listening audience to talk about science, to talk about connecting science with society. You provide so many opportunities on your program, not only today, but throughout the week. And I want to start by thanking you and saluting you for doing that. It's so critical that we do this.
Well, thank you, Bassam. And you have been promoting science and a basic understanding of science for a long, long time, not only on this program, but professionally and otherwise. Why is it so important to you?
We live in the most advanced society in history, and these advances are because of science and technology. They're because people appreciate science, people support scientific inquiry, people learn, people want to satisfy their curiosities, people want to develop new technologies to help improve the quality of life in society. You know, Larry, science and technology are the engines that drive our economy. Economic prosperity is very dependent on new technologies, innovation, transferring basic research results to the market. It's really, really very important that we all develop a sense of appreciation of science and learn about you know, what science deals with. It does not deal with all human concerns and domains, but learn what science is, what we can benefit from science, and how it helps us. You know, the Industrial Revolution has resulted in us being the way we are now. We enjoy life. Lifespan has increased. Healthcare is much better. Transportation, communications. We can go down the list here. But we are now in the infancy of the electronic revolution. And we must pay close attention to that so that with artificial intelligence and other aspects of it, biotechnology, that we have a sense of responsibility for handling and dealing with the wonderful things that can result, but also with the adverse problems that can develop. So that's essentially why I and so many other people feel that connecting science with society is crucial to the well-being of each one of us, individually and collectively, in communities, in groups, no matter what our religious beliefs are, no matter what our political affiliations are, we live in the most advanced society in history, and we have an awesome responsibility not only to enjoy it, Larry, but to maintain it and to sustain it.
You know, I was thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking back. It's been, I believe, more than 20 years ago that you founded the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy at UW-Madison. I think you're still its director. Talk about that initiative. What does that initiative do?
Well, very briefly and succinctly, I hope, the mission of the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy is to promote literacy in science, mathematics, and technology among the general public, and also to attract future generations to careers in research, scientific research, in teaching, and in public service. This is the succinct statement of purpose of the initiative. Now, why science literacy? Science and science literacy are necessary for the democratic process to work. Science literacy enlightens and enables people to make informed choices and to be skeptical. In science, we're always skeptical, Larry. We ask questions. We challenge authority. We want to really know how the world works and how our role in the world contributes to the well-being of not only each other, but to the survival of the planet. So we want to enable people to make informed choices, to be skeptical, and to reject shames, quackery, unproven conjecture, and to avoid being bamboozled into making foolish decisions where matters of science and technology are concerned. This is the essence, and this is the heart of what the Initiative for Science Literacy is about. And we aim to learn from each other, work with each other in respectful ways, and we hope that we are able to enjoy what we do. We might disagree with each other, but our disagreement should be civil in the way we interact with each other, no matter how strongly we disagree with each other.
Yeah. Well, that initiative is really linked to something I really enjoy. Your website, which is Science is Fun, includes a lot of information, including what I think are pretty cool science activities that you can do at home. And people, what do people learn from doing their own science experiments?
We can learn a lot. But Larry, may I just say one more thing about science literacy?
Sure.
Science literacy is an attitude. Attitudes do not develop overnight. They have to be nurtured. They have to be nourished. They have to be part of continuous and continual engagement with each other. So science literacy, it's like personal hygiene. It's everyone should have an appreciation of science. Some people want to have a deep understanding of science. And we promote all that together. We do it together. So the website is one attempt to do that. We have a variety of entries on the website, including experiments you can do at home. If you go to the website, which is scifun.org, in the upper left corner, you click on the entry there, and you see that we have a whole variety of experiments you can do at home safely. I invite people who are in the listening audience to visit the website, check the experiments you can download and do at home, but please do not do them alone. They're very safe to do. I say do not do them alone because I'm a strong advocate of family interactions around topics that are meaningful to youngsters and to adults. So do experiments. They're safe to do at home. They have been tested repeatedly. Everything has been reviewed carefully. Everything on my website has been carefully reviewed. But the experimentation, hands-on experiments, are really important to cultivate an attitude that, as I keep saying, helps us understand the world that we live in and learn that it's all right to ask questions and it's all right to say, I don't know, when the question is asked, but there are ways to find out.
You know, the Institute for Science Literacy Project, it has a project, I think it's the newest one. It's called The Science of Sound, which is pretty cool. Here we are. We're a hearing medium at Wisconsin Public Radio and radio in general. But tell us about the Science of Sound project.
So if you go to the website, scifund.org, on the homepage, you'll see a variety of entries, but the newest one is called The Science of Sound. And take your cursor and hover a bit around over the Science of Sound entry before you click on it, and you'll see what happens. Why the Science of Sound? Well, you know, we're interested in sharing information, developing knowledge about hearing, and it's one of the senses. It's an important aspect of enables us to communicate with each other. So there's a pressure pulse that is responsible for the sensation of sound. And this, when the sound wave enters the ear, it produces the sensation. So these pulses, these pressure pulses in the air, you have to have a medium to have this pressure pulse. That travels through the air and hits the ear, enters the ear canal, and when the inner ear, the different parts of the ear, the inner part of the canal, that causes pulses that strike the eardrum, and the pulses cause the drum to move in and out. That's why it's called an eardrum. These motions of the ear drum are then transferred to a series of several bones that are in there, and they transmit the motion to the cochlea. In the cochlea, there's the motion is converted to electrical signals, and the electrical signals are sent to the brain. So this is the introduction to how hearing works, and how the how we hear.
It's pretty cool. I was thinking back. I interviewed Daniel Levitin, who's written a book. I heard there was a secret chord, music as medicine, and it brings to bear a lot of the science about how music can serve in a variety of medical situations. A very fascinating book. I think I interviewed him on August 26th, so if anybody wants to go back and listen to that particular show, they can do it. And of course, we're really interested in sound here at Wisconsin Public Radio. How did the project come about? I mean, what was the genesis for it?
We've been involved for decades in developing material to share with faculty, with teachers, high school teachers, grade school teachers, with the public at large about science. And we published a series of books called Chemical Demonstrations. And the fifth volume dealt with color, light, vision, and perception. Those five volumes are printed volumes. Now, for the Science of Sound, which you might consider the next volume in the series, although it's not printed, we put it on the web, and my colleague, my long-time friend and colleague, Rodney Schreiner, is responsible for putting all this material together. He's just a very insightful, highly knowledgeable and caring person who put all the pieces that you will be able to look at when you visit the Science of Sound on the web. So we consider this to be a continuation of the series of ways by which we like to share the joy of learning. We like to ask questions. We like to have people formulate their own questions. We like to try to help satisfy curiosities. We try to nurture curiosity. So that's the continuation of the series that we've been doing. And it's in keeping with modern technology now. We're not abandoning print, but we're saying this is a highly interactive entry. And I would like to invite people to visit the website and tell us back what they think about it, what questions they have, how to change it, how to improve it. And because the entries on the web are all living documents. So Rodney Schreiner and I and others on the staff welcome hearing from people who have questions, comments about not only the science of sound, but about everything that we have on the website.
Yeah. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, the William T. Abu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin at the UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. And we'll invite you to join in now. If you have a question or comment, I hope you will. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News as we talk science with Bassam Shakashiri. We were just talking about the science of sound, and I want to give a big thanks to everybody who heard our request during our fall member drive. Thanks to everybody who donated during the fall member drive. We had people like Vicky and Two Rivers helping there and making WPR's essential service possible. If you missed the member drive, still time to join in. You could go to WPR.org and make a contribution. Now more, I think more than ever, you play a very important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected. And thanks again for helping us out with that very strong WPR member drive. Really appreciate it. Everyone here appreciates your contributions. Well, science is happening all around us all the time. Bassam, and I think it was last Monday, we celebrated the autumnal equinox. That, of course, marks the official start of fall in the Northern Hemisphere. And if I'm not mistaken, the official start of spring in the Southern Hemisphere. But let's talk about the autumnal equinox. What is it exactly?
The equinox is, of course, twice a year. It's when the Earth's axis is tilted neither toward nor away from the sun. It's straight up to the sun, which results in having an equal amount of daylight and darkness all over the world. So people know that the Earth is tilted, right, Larry?
Yeah.
People know why we have four seasons, and maybe we should think about that. We've talked about this several times before. Why do we have four seasons? The fall equinox is the beginning of the fall season, and it occurred, as you say, a week ago in the Northern Hemisphere. So in the Southern Hemisphere, it's the beginning of spring. I think it's important for us to enjoy learning about these events that happen, and also enjoy looking at the changes that accompany those events. So it's really important to learn about. The word equinox comes from Latin, right? It means equal, mm-hmm. and it has to do. In this connection, I'd like to once again, as I have done before on your program, Larry, refer people to a study that was done about 40 years ago, asking students and faculty members at Harvard University why we have four seasons. And this is a program called the Private Universe. I will put a link to that on my website, and perhaps you can also do it again.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of not knowing. It's a matter of saying, I don't know, and we can find out. In this study, 23 out of 25 Harvard faculty members did not know the correct explanation as to why we have four seasons. At least in this interview, they did not know. So, but this is a telltale of how important it is for all of us, not only to be subspecializing in areas of knowledge, in areas of business, but to have a wider perspective about what the environment is that we live in. And again, especially among youngsters, to nurture and nourish curiosity.
You know, I bet there are a few thousand people are wondering to themselves, wait a minute, why do we have four seasons? Maybe you could take a minute and just explain how that works.
Well, the Earth the axis of the Earth is tilted. And so rotation and they're going around the sun. We do agree that the Earth goes around the sun, right, Larry?
I think so.
Well, that's because of science and because of common understanding, and that we agree to that. Okay, then as the tilt continues and the rotation continues, the tilt goes away from being straight up toward the sun, and that's why we have the differences in the amount of sunlight that comes during the day, of course, to our planet. And again, the differences between the northern and southern hemispheres. And all of this is related to climate change and related to understanding the beautiful, complex world that we live in.
Yeah.
Once again, I invite everyone to ask questions and perhaps visit my website, and we can provide more detailed information, not only about the four seasons, but about all the topics that relate to science and technology that we have brought up today.
Yeah. Well, you did mention climate change, and let's talk about, for maybe a minute or two, about the economic and environmental consequences we can expect from the effects of climate change.
Well, climate change is unequivocal, and it's important for us to understand why this is happening, how it's happening, and what we can do about it. Let's just take two specific examples from Wisconsin. The duration of ice on the surface of Lake Mendota has been tracked for many, many years. And the duration of ice, that period is getting shorter and shorter. That is one telltale of that the planet is warming. That's one of the telltales. And another one is the so-called plant hardiness zones. Those are the zones that gardeners and farmers use to put the seeds in and so on. And it's very clear that these zones now are shifting in a direction that tells us that the temperature is getting warmer. Once again, I have graphic displays of what I'm saying here on the website, and they are on other websites too, and the other guys talk about this too. So I invite you to look at the science of climate change. It's an entry we have on the website. All of these displays critically show that the planet is warming. So the economic consequences of this, well, you know, I mentioned farming. Then there are situations where the areas around the planet become drier.
Oh, I think we temporarily lost Bassam Shakashiri here for a minute. We'll get him back. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, and I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts about science. Maybe it has to do with climate change or other things that we've talked about relating to science, or maybe you've got something else to bring up. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could go to talk@WPR.org. Send us an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll take a quick break and then we'll be back with Bassam. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk science with Bassam Shakashiri. We lost him there for a minute, but we have him back. And Bassam, as you were talking, and we lost you there, you were talking about climate change effects, and you were using an example of Wisconsin agriculture.
Yes, I was. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was using the example of what's called the plant hardiness zones. This is a very clear indication of how winter temperatures are changing, and this affects farming, for example. There are other. So I was inviting our listening audience to look at this graphical display of the plant hardiness zones. They're on my website, scifund.org. And they are on other websites too. And learn more about the science of climate change and the consequences of what is happening to the planet. So that's important that we learn about that. And I use the example about the surface of the ice on the surface of Lake Mendota.
Yeah,
you heard that, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Marion Spooner has a question relating to what we were just talking about. Mary, go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Okay. I would just like a little bit more information about the reasons for the four seasons, and you mentioned the tilting of the axis, but could you elaborate a little bit more on how this works? Does it have to do with the rotation of the Earth around the sun, or?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Earth is going around its own axis as well. That's but the Earth is also moving around the sun, and the relationship between the rotation around the axis as it changes with time as we go around the sun is what gives us daylight, of course, and nighttime, but also gives us the with the tilt, then it changes the amount of daylight that happens, and that is the reason, that is the explanation for why we have the four seasons.
Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Michael in DeForest, we'll go to you. Michael, hello.
Hello. I have an interesting question. I would like to know if we will ever get to the point where we no longer need science, then we will know it all. And what percent are we in advancement on science in history?
Oh, All right.
That's a very, very good question. I'll tell you, the more we know, the more we realize how little we know. Science will continue to help us understand the world that we live in. Technology will also help us, I hope, live better with each other. There are ways by which technology can be extremely helpful, and also technology can cause harm. So the nature of the human mind is to ask questions and seek explanations and answers. And in science, the explanations and the answers change because we learn more. We get better at asking questions. So science, to borrow from a book that was published in the 1950s, science is the endless frontier. We just keep at it. Does that help with your question?
Yes. Where do you think we're at in advancement in science? I mean, compared to human history and science, whereabouts are we as far as how much we know?
Well, as I said, we know a lot more now than we did before. But we also realize that what we know is so small compared to what we can learn. And that's why we pursue scientific research. That's why we have disciplined approaches to formulating questions and trying to come up with answers and explanations to those questions. I dare say that the end of science would be the end of curiosity, and that's not going to happen.
Yeah. I was thinking back, I think it was in the 50s, maybe early 50s, where someone made the pronouncement, someone, that we had learned everything that we would ever learn. And that there, we had advanced to the point where we could probably will never advance further than we were. That was in 1950, thereabouts. And you can see that if you think back to where we were in 1950 and where we are in 2025, it's been a whole range of improvements and learning. And I bet you, in 50 years from now, what scientists will be talking about is this will be looked at as a period of pretty good, but nothing like what we've got now.
I agree with what you're saying, Larry, and I think everyone has the right to say whatever they want to say, but to say that we've learned as much as we can learn, that is that's perhaps a telltale of not understanding enough about the nature of human beings.
Michael, thank you very much for calling. We've still got a long way to go on the science side, but we've made a lot of advancements. John in Janesville, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I just had listened in about the four seasons, and I'm an old geography teacher, and that was one of my first things with my seventh grade students. The question of why, rather than memorizing all of the data for the various, the Tropic of Cancer and when does the sun hit there at a 90-degree angle and so on, and those are all important things. But trying to explain why something does happen rather than just, will you just memorize this? And I think that's what science is trying to, why did a city grow so big here when it didn't someplace else, or what, there's reasons for what we've done. So I think sometimes we're losing sight of the why and asking those questions. And I don't know, maybe we don't want to know the real true answers maybe. So
No, we want to know. We want to know. What are you talking about? I say that respectfully, right? You know that, right?
Yeah. John, thank you very much. Thanks for your comment, John. Appreciate it. Winona, who is driving through Keeble, has something for us. Winona, hi.
Hi. Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to first mention that for the last two summers, I've been teaching math science in our local public school as a summer school class. And we have not done a lot of what the kids call the advanced experiments, which involve things exploding. We've done a lot of documenting and evidence work and questions and using critical thinking skills. And even though they don't always like it at first, by the end of the 4 weeks, they're doing it and they're appreciating it. But my question, because it's starting to come up more, is how do we handle if we believe that science is important, and yes, you should be skeptical, and you should be curious. How do we handle the way it's been politicized, especially over the last couple of years, and in some cases really diminished in terms of attitudes about science?
Yeah.
That's my question.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Bassam?
Yeah, very good question. Thank you. We have to think hard and improve the ways in which we share scientific knowledge with each other. We do this formally in the classroom, but we also do it outside the classroom. And so it is part of the awesome responsibility of scientists to pursue scientific research, but it's also incumbent upon us to share the results of these pursuits in manners, in ways that are appreciated by audiences in the classroom and outside the classroom. So I think it's an important part, not only to improve the methods of communication, but to think about why we want this communication to happen, and to also, in the process of communication, to listen to each other. Communication is not a one-way street. Education is not a one-way street. I learned so much as a classroom teacher and also from being outside the classroom as I probably learned from having been a student in the classroom. So the attitude that we have about connecting science with society should be examined, and individuals and groups and communities should think about how this can be improved so that it becomes effective. And I have great admiration for my colleagues and the science faculty and for high school teachers, grade school teachers, who want to do a better job of teaching science. It's not only memorizing the facts, as a previous caller was saying. It is about the process of science, the inquiry that we engage in, and how we work with each other, and how skeptical we are about an answer that we might come up with. As I say, I keep emphasizing the word solutions more so than answers. So we have to think about sharing science with society now differently than what we have done in the past. What do I mean by that? I mentioned already that the electronic revolution is in its infancy. So we have to find ways to better use technology, educational technology, to not only share information and share knowledge, but to engage in meaningful, respectful dialogues about what is being shared. So this is a challenge to all of us.
Dave, thank you for calling. David and Phillips has something that relates, I believe. David, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for this call and this program. I wondered if you think that Thomas Kuhn's fundamental book on the structure of scientific revolutions should somehow be, you know, interpreted or, you know, brought back as trying to find a common ground understanding of the paradigms of scientific inquiry, because it seems to me that people have fundamental differences on how they think, and in doing so, they might, you know, we might be experiencing, as we are now, you know, rejection of good science by people who just think about it differently. So I wondered if you could comment on Kuhn's book, and if it should be brought back in a more functional way.
Sort of a paradigm. Yes. Paradigm
yes,
shift. Yeah, go ahead, Sam.
Yes, we should all have a look at Tom Kuhn's book. There's no question about it. And to understand what he was addressing, it is exactly along the lines that you're mentioning. So there is the understanding that scientists themselves have about what they do and how they do it. There's also the understanding, and I hope appreciation, of what scientists communicate to people who are not scientists. I'm a firm believer in that science and society have a social contract that enables great intellectual achievements. But this social contract comes with expectations of benefiting the human condition and protecting our planet. And these paradigm shifts that you're talking about, that Thomas Kuhn talked about, should be part of the conversation. We should all express ourselves about that. We should participate. I want to underscore the word participate. We should participate in dialogues among each other, with each other, about such matters. And Larry, your program does a wonderful job in this regard. And I, as I mentioned earlier, I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. David, appreciate your call. And this, I did want to, before we, well, we still have time, but I wanted to bring up the Wisconsin Science Festival that's coming up. It's, you know, it started, I think it was 3 days. Now it's 10 days with events taking place in all 52 counties. Give us a little on the Wisconsin Science Festival.
Oh, it's a marvelous opportunity. It's been expanded, as you just said, to 10 days. This is the 15th annual Wisconsin Science Festival. It will be held from October 16th. Till October 26th, all over the state in 52 counties, and it celebrates discoveries in science. It encourages people to ask questions, to do experiments. It also celebrates the all important connection between the arts and the sciences, and there's so many different programs. I invite people to visit the Wisconsin Science Festival website, where all of these events are mentioned all over the state. Just Google Wisconsin Science Festival 2025. The theme of the festival is Curiosity Unleashed. So many wonderful programs, shining spotlights, as I said, on the arts woven into science. Programs like sound waves, crossroads of ideas, bringing performance and science together in creative ways. Their curiosity fuels creativity. It's a wonderful set of activities for every person in the family, from youngsters to grandparents and great-grandparents. You're all invited to do this, to really enjoy the interactions also between people who do scientific research and the public on topics relating how to humanize science, how to build trust,
how to show how research connects to everyday life and has practical implications, and also to address the very all-important, challenging current climate of supporting scientific research in our country. This is a very important aspect of what's going to happen in the Science Festival. So the Wisconsin Science Festival, all are invited to participate in this. And I'm so happy and pleased with this, now the 15th annual Wisconsin Science Festival.
And it's occurring, it's bound to be in an area near you because it's in 52 of our 72 counties. So practically the biggest portion of the counties of the state are having this science festival, and well worth your time for sure. We have Mary in Gladstone, Michigan has a question or comment. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I know that ever since the, and probably well before the development of the atomic bomb, we've known that there are some hazards related to progress in science and risks. And I'm just wondering where, how you view this huge, huge growth in AI, and who knows where we'll go from here in terms of the hazards of progress in science.
Yeah, thanks, Mary.
That's a very, very important question for all of us to know about and to think about. So AI has many great benefits to all of us, but it also can lead to potential hazards and damage. And we need to understand what is really happening right now. Things are changing on a daily basis in artificial intelligence, and it's very hard to keep up with that. But we should devote part of our time on a weekly basis, maybe on a daily basis, to learn more about what artificial intelligence consequences might be. There are conversations among people to develop standards of ethics for that. Well, how can they be enforced? So this is a very important aspect of human development that relates to advances in science and technology, so we can not only benefit, but also protect ourselves and protect our planet.
Had some nice emails as well, Paulette. Every Monday, her theme as a teacher was science experiments. They invited students to experiment at home and bring in to share with class. The curiosity was piqued and many questions were asked. She only wishes she would have had your website, scifund.org, to use as a resource. And so as we close here, I want to just remind people, the things we talked about today you're going to find on scifund.org. And Bassam, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to another visit from you. Thank you, Bassam.
Thank you, Larry, for the opportunity once again. Thank you so much.
Bassam Shakashiri, an emeritus professor of chemistry and the William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA at UW-Madison. Great to have him along. And great to welcome up next our weather guys to talk climate and weather. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thank you. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, it's time to talk climate and weather. We're keeping our kind of our science theme here today. And the weather, guys, it's obviously the last Monday of the month. And Steve Ackerman and John Martin are back with us. Steve is the former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here and glad to hear you put weather and science together.
John Martin, our other weather guy, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison as well. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
As we talk with them, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Give us your latest weather experience, or maybe you've got a question, or maybe you have a weather photo. We'd love to have you send your interesting weather photos to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Of course, you can always ask a question as you email it in. But you can also call us. We'd love that, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Well, let's start about September, talking about September. There was a warm September. Last week was the autumnal equinox. We talked about that a little bit with Bassam Shakashiri. September ends tomorrow. Cool temperatures are usually the norm. We're getting to be the norm this time of the year, but what's happening? It's 80s.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the norm. I mean, looking at this for last week's newspaper column, we've had multiple Septembers where temperatures have been above 80. It's rare to find one that doesn't have a few temperatures above 80, as it turns out. However, when you get to this point in the year, we're about at the climatologically, that is long-term average, last 80-degree day. I think it's either today, tomorrow, or Wednesday, somewhere right around the 1st of October. However, last year, the last 80-degree day set a record on October 29th. So it's conceivable we still have a month left of visitations by 80 Fahrenheit or higher. And honestly, I don't see any reason not to expect that over the next 10 days. We're going to have several between now and then.
And it just doesn't fit with October weather.
I know.
For me, my personal experience, I want to see the cool weather and the leaves changing.
Some of them are just drying right up and falling off.
Yeah,
you know, the ones that still are on the trees are largely green, I'll grant you. But there's a whole bunch in the gutter that are dried up. And so they're falling somewhat stealthily as they dry out, because it's been dry, too, over this period. So,
so it's not just the warm, it's the dry weather.
It seems like they can both conspire,
They're falling slowly, which is nice, because I can just run my mulching mower over them and I don't have to rake.
Yeah. I like that, too. I like
been
that.
Been there, done that.
Love that.
Well, should we be worry or just enjoy the warmth?
I think we should be concerned. All right. I keep track of the Northern Hemisphere's change to the fall from fall into winter. And for the first 25 days of September, this year was the ninth warmest September in the Northern Hemisphere over that period of time since 1948. So out of 78 seasons. That's unusual. And all of the ones that are ahead of it, you know, from numbers 1 through 8, were in the last 10 years. This is not normal.
Yeah.
It's become the new normal, and the new normal is too warm, and it's bound to cause a lot of problems.
It's certainly the trend that we're seeing. The warming, global warming, is real. We're seeing it no matter what some of our leaders say. And this 80-degree weather, maybe we just start looking for November.
exactly.
Real weather time.
Yep.
Well, Jamie in Algoma has a weather-related question, so let's go there. Jamie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm not sure if it's a weather-related question. We're wondering if it is. We noticed this weekend that when we tried to listen to WPR or last night WIXX for the Packers game, we couldn't get our radios to tune you in for anything. We found one radio that would work. We're listening on the app right now because it just won't come in. We're wondering if it could be related to sunspots or some atmospheric thing, or do you guys have any clue?
So,
I don't think there is some increase in solar activity, but I don't think it's going on right now with this particular day. That would also impact transmission of a radio signal. I don't know if they still do it. Run the signal off and bounce it off the ionosphere. Is that the way you typically?
I don't know.
We don't do it that way very much.
I guess in that case, you get better reception at certain times of the day. It tended to be the case in the old days. But Steve, I think you're exactly right. I mean, 50 years ago, there may have been a solar event that was causing disruptions for broadcast that we wouldn't know about. We weren't monitoring it. But now, there's no way you wouldn't hear that independently, that there's something going on, probably. Right. So I don't know what the answer might be.
Well, maybe somebody else has an idea. I know there's a difference on how the sound waves work between AM and FM.
Yeah.
No, that's true. That's good you have the app. I mean, I now listen to Wisconsin Public Radio when I work out. Turn the app on. It's really amazing.
Well, maybe somebody else has some ideas on it too, Jamie. We'll keep listening and we'll see what we can come up with in addition to what we've already said. And you can join in, maybe have a comment on Jamie's experience, or maybe you have another question relating to weather or climate, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. On September 16th, I think it was, the Wisconsin State Climatology Office issued its latest report describing the past summer as wet, warm, and sticky, which is the scientific way to put it, I guess. It's the one that we all know.
I
assume they mean humidity-wise in terms of sticky.
So the summer, was the summer atypical in any way?
I think they hit it on all three counts. Yeah. It wasn't the warmest summer we've ever had. 1988 was probably in the last 50 years one of the warmer ones. But it was persistently muggy here, and I think that showed up in the statistics. The average dew point was higher over the course of this summer than it was in many recent summers. I forget what the next competitor was. We had a nice presentation in our department by Steve Avris, who's the director of the State Climatology Office, a couple of Fridays ago. And we also had that August 9th and 10th heavy rain event in the Milwaukee County region and across the southern part of the state, but especially Milwaukee County, which may have set the all-time single-day precipitation record for the state of Wisconsin. It's still being determined. A high school with a monitoring station just northwest of Milwaukee City itself had 14.95 inches of rain, I think, in a 24-hour period, which would break the old record if it stands up to the scrutiny by over almost 3 inches.
Wow.
So it's it's in another category entirely.
Yeah.
And the city itself that day had 9.5, I think, or something like that. So it was a remarkable rain event. So that was another feature of our recent summer. So it was unusual.
And so those storms wring that moisture out of the atmosphere and bring it to the ground.
I mean, we walked home from the ball game that night to our car about a mile away, and we were hit by, you know, pigeon egg-sized raindrops, freshly melted hailstones. They were huge. They were the kind that come out of tropical storms.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Well, Vincent Burlington has something may relate to this. I'm not sure. Vince, hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. In 25 words or less, can you describe the expected changes with the Gulf Stream and its impact on the weather in Europe?
Oh, on Europe. Hmm. Oh.
Well, there's theories out there that seem now to be, it's going to be over 25 words. I got to give you a little preamble. Right. These theories seem to have been overstated, that the Gulf Stream can suddenly shut down. Were it to shut down suddenly, a transport of really warm water, enormous volumes of warm water to high latitudes, would drastically change the weather of northwestern Europe. It would make it a lot colder, probably a little drier, but a lot colder for sure. And more representative of being at 50 to 60 degrees latitude. Those people get away with murder in terms of temperature, given their latitude, because of the Gulf Stream. And if it suddenly shut down, it'd be a lot colder there.
Yeah.
But you don't see, there's nothing to suggest that it's going to shut down.
Well, there's plenty to suggest it could. It's just that I think that the most recent stuff we've heard in our department from scholars who travel through has been that maybe it's been a little bit exaggerated how quickly it could shut down. But one of the key things to driving the Gulf Stream and the importation poleward of that warm water is cooling making the water more salty in the far North Atlantic. And so if cold air outbreaks with dry cold air come over the Labrador Sea, they can take water out by evaporation, make it saltier, and make it colder by contact with the cold air. If that shuts down, that's a big pump for the Gulf Stream. So as the planet warms, that's a risk.
Is sea ice melting in terms of putting fresh water and over then, it?
Yeah, that's
well,
right. Freshening it is also bad news. Yep. Because it's less dense water, it won't sink.
Right.
Yeah.
Vince, there you go. Thank you for calling. Charlie in Menominee, we'll turn to you. Thanks for calling, Charlie.
Yeah, I was listening to the lady who mentioned about not being able to pick up nearby radio or TV stations. But, you know, there's a thing called, I think it's called isotropic inversion or something like that. And it tends to happen, I think, when it's real in the summertime. Where I know that when I lived over in Door County, I couldn't pick up local Green Bay stations, but I was able to pick up a TV station out of Kitchener, Ontario. and so there is maps that I don't think I'm saying the right term, isotropic inversion or something like that. And there's maps that they put out to see how active it is, and if you know, and rates the zones for you know your part of the part of the country. And if we're like at a level 9, that seemed like, oh, you're not going to get local stations, but you might be getting something 500-600 miles away.
Wow, that's weird.
So so I recommend she looks up, reasons why your radio signal wouldn't be coming in now, or you know, close by ones, but far away ones are. And this map would, you know, you'll get to that website.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah, okay. That's very cool.
I didn't know they were available so quickly.
Yeah, me either. Yeah, and I think if the word that you used isn't precise, we don't know either. But if it isn't the right exact word, it strikes me that it sounds a little bit like ionosphere or ionospheric or something like that. And that was Steve's comment. So
yeah,
there might be something going on in the upper part of the atmosphere that encourages this. Really interesting.
Yeah. Well, an isotropic inversion is a geophysical or mechanical modeling technique that assumes a material's properties are the same in all directions, which is then used to analyze data that may actually exhibit.
So it's the method to analyze the data.
Yeah,
sort of like when we do we do inversions. There's temperature inversions, but there's also inversion equating.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Charlie, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Rick in Elkhart Lake will give you a chance. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You were talking about global warming before, and I thought I had read a couple days ago that China now produces at least 25% of their electricity from renewables, and cars, 50% of the cars that they sell are fully electric now. So I wonder if this might be some cause for celebration or some ray of hope. I realize the United States is getting left behind, but I was, if that's true, I was impressed with the progress that's been made.
Yeah, I read that 25% number as well. I didn't read the whole article, but it is a good sign, I think, considering how much energy they consume in particular.
Yeah. It's a bad sign, though, because we'll be trailing them.
Yes, by
you
lot.
Know, I'd much rather be exporting that technology than importing it at a premium. And that's where, you know, dropping the ball on purpose the way we've done recently is really horrible. It certainly doesn't make America first. It makes America second at best. And if China's first, then we're going to pay whatever China decides we're going to pay for the new energy revolution. So, yes, I agree. It's encouraging that this can be done. Well, why did it have to be proven overseas before we decided to have enough confidence to do it here? Yeah. It's ludicrous. But hopefully we can pick it up.
Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our weather guys, our guests today, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we visit with Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys from UW-Madison. It's great to have them back. And questions, join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Dean in Evergreen, Colorado. Hi, Dean.
Hey, guys. Hey, great as always to hear from you, and thanks for taking my question. By the way, I have to take exception to all this warm weather talk. We're sailors, and we were planning on taking our boat, our sailboat, up to Lake Superior to go sailing on it this fall, but or summer, late summer, I should say. But we had a problem with our rudder. Anyway, our friends from Pueblo did make it up there, and they endured some winter on Isle Royale the beginning of this month.
Oh, yeah. Beginning of the month was cold.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Heavy wind, too, so they were out in some pretty tough seas there. But anyway, and I should say, I think it's Steve, that one from Boston and Wisconsin in search of winter.
No, that's me.
That's John.
Oh, John, yeah.
No, I wasn't searching for winter. I was just hoping I'd get a facsimile.
Yeah, well, you didn't go far enough west. We have snow here. In fact, the higher elevations got 6 to 8 inches up at the ski resorts this past week here in Colorado.
Oh, I didn't realize
it's
that.
It's always the same story, though, Dean. I was in Seattle for 8 years. Yeah, just go to the mountains. You'll get snow. Of course you will. I want to see it at sea level.
Well, you've got a question, though, I believe.
I'm getting to it. Yes, thank you. So my training is in meteorology, but I wandered off into micrometeorology. So I'm a little unfamiliar with what's evolved since the dawn of time when I went to undergraduate school. And so it's popular on the, or as far as I can access, are two models that you guys aren't quite familiar with. GFS, which is an American model, and ECMWF, which is a European model. And when I access those model outputs on the internet, I can get a forecast, I can understand. But is there more in that final analysis? When you see a weather model, for instance, is that a compilation of different analyses that are gathered into one final product? And I wonder that because I see these hurricane forecasts, which have spaghetti models output, and they say that comes out of these longer range forecasts.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's a good question. The forecast model is a computer-based tool that takes information, initial conditions, and then runs forward a simulation of the atmosphere and how it will behave in the near term, 0 to 3 days, sometimes longer than that. There's a lot of pre-processing of the collection of global data that goes into giving the model those initial conditions. And so that's one enormously important step, and it's called data assimilation. So we try to assimilate all the different platforms, all the different data sources that can come into informing the model about what might happen in the future. So the assimilation process is extraordinarily important. The European Center does a better job at that than we do in the United States, and there's no good reason for that. One of our colleagues in our department, Professor Michael Morgan, spent the last 2.5 years at NOAA in the Biden administration working on that very problem. And the U.S. weather bill that just passed a few weeks ago is making a huge incremental increase in our efforts in data assimilation. Because Michael told me that the actual computer code that runs the global forecast system model, the GFS you mentioned, Dean, gives a better forecast than the European Center model. Most people will say, wait a minute, no, that's not the popular story. But the European Center model does a better job as part of their assimilation. So if you take their assimilated data and run it through the GFS, you get a better forecast every time. So our modeling's better, but our assimilation's worse. But the other aspect that pertains to your question is you can run multiple simulations using the same initial conditions that you only slightly perturb, make them slightly different, and that's called an ensemble forecast. That's run routinely now for everyday weather, but it's especially highlighted when it comes time to forecasting the track and intensification history of an upcoming tropical cyclone. So they almost always go to an ensemble, and that gives you all the multiple lines on the so-called spaghetti plots that are possible solutions for what happens with that storm. That's now become routine.
So in the ensemble forecast where you're doing hurricane tracks, do they do it a lot more because we really don't have the data observations there and therefore they want to tweak it and play with it a little bit more?
That's a really good question, Steve. It's a combination that the data is insufficient, probably, as it always is when you're trying to model something in the atmosphere. The other thing is that the small-scale processes that you're trying to replicate in the model have to be parameterized. They have to be given a sort of a not quite precise calculation, something less than precise. And you want to try several different ways to do that less than precise calculation and see how that impacts the forecast.
Yeah.
So fooling around with the so-called parameterizations is another reason to have multiple solutions on a given forecast day that you want to see. I want to know what the range of a variable or variation is on this track or this intensity.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. Dean, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Mary in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Yeah, I was wondering about case weather. I remember that, years back. I'm 80 now. And I was wondering if anyone's tracking that.
Case weather.
Case when you put something up.
As somebody who...
tobacco, right?
Harvested and worked in tobacco fields when he was a young man, and that's how I made quite a bit of money late in the fall. Mm. And then again in around January, there's a time the tobacco leaves the tobacco plants are speared onto laths and hung to dry in tobacco sheds. Mm. And at some point, those tobacco plants need to be taken down and the leaves stripped off and put into bales. And material, the paper that was used were put in cases. And I don't know if that's why it's called case weather, but the thing about January is almost invariably you would get a more humid week. The humidity would go up, which would be infused into the leaves. Mm. And so when you were taking the leaves off the tobacco plant itself, they wouldn't crumble up.
Up.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
And you'd lay the leaves in the slot, and then when you get around 50 pounds or so, where when that particular case filled up, then you wrapped the paper around and tied it up. Uh-huh. And so case weather was weather a time period when the humidity would go up after this long drying spell, which would have occurred September, October through till January.
Mm.
Typically January,
yeah,
but about a week.
So I wonder if it's tied to the old and somewhat resonant in the statistics of a January thaw. You know, where it warms up a little bit, because the only way to get the humidity up is to warm the air up at that in the dead of winter. And we almost get always like a four or five or 6 day period, mid to late January, where the temperatures climb to 40 degrees, even if they've been hovering near zero for much of the winter. So it's interesting. I wonder if they're connected that way.
Well, I'm sure that any tobacco farmer would have known, you'd be watching the weather and when you were going to get that higher humidity. And then you were out in the tobacco shed, the stripping shed, as they call it. You'd be stripping the tobacco leaves off the plant. Mm. And because they were now a little damper.
They wouldn't crumble.
They wouldn't crumble.
Yeah. Wow.
Mary, I don't know if we answered your question here.
I just heard November, when it's really foggy and warm.
Yeah,
and
it could be any month after the tobacco had sort of dried, like a leaf on a tree dries, but then they become very brittle.
Yeah,
and so it could be November. Mm. I think my memory was always January was that time when that happened. Mm.
That's so interesting. So was the idea that you dried it out to get rid of all the water. You don't want to be selling people water in the leaves. And then it gets a little bit more just pliant because it gets humid on the surface.
Just gets a little more
pliant.
How
do you like that? That's so interesting. Yeah. So it could happen at any time. In a cold climate like ours, it could be November. You could have a warm
spell.
It could
be November as long as the leaves were
dry.
Dry enough.
Dried out.
Yeah, okay. Oh, interesting.
So there you go, Mary. I remember making a fair amount of money during the tobacco harvest season. And I had neighbors, most of our neighbors had tobacco.
Wow, so interesting.
Stoughton and Cottage Grove area.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of handwork.
Yeah, I imagine it's tough work.
Thank you again for calling. You can join in too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Dave in Appleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. So we vacation in Gulf Shores, Alabama, January and February. And although it's not a really hot time to go, we can always say at least the white stuff is sand on the beaches. Except for last year we got 9 inches of snow, and the last notable snow event, I think, was in 1993, and they were building snowmen on the beaches. They didn't have any shovels. Everything's closed down for days. What's up with that, and when do we expect the next one?
They are rare down that far south. Famous events like the one you're talking about occurred in 1895. Was a really tremendous freeze in early February of 1895 down the south. And there have been a few other ones, and you mentioned one from 93 was also noteworthy. But I'd say that the spacing between them is probably every 20 to 30 to 40 years. They're really unusual that far south, but they do occur. And it's just a function of, you know, how do all the tumblers in the lock line up that year? And you can get a really substantial cold air outbreak that really penetrates far southward. You got abundant moisture down there. It's not going to be hard to squeeze water vapor out of the air when you bring a weather system in there. You just got to have it cold enough to snow. And once in a while, it does.
Does that air just come out of Canada?
Yeah, that comes straight out of Canada. Races straight down from the Central Plains, the prairie provinces, in cases like that. Yeah. Another famous one was 1780 in Charleston, South Carolina, in mid-February. I think that was when the British occupied the city during the Revolutionary War, and they lost a lot of men and equipment on piers that were kind of going out to the boats because they got overloaded with snow. They couldn't shovel it fast enough, so the piers broke.
Wow.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
No,
I can't.
Unbelievable.
You're a font of knowledge there.
When it comes to snow, I know a few things.
Dave, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Ed in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I hope your learned guest might be able to advise me on the purchase of an aneroid barometer. I've been having bad luck with them. They don't seem to last more than 2 years. And I believe it's kind of a diaphragm affair, I believe, inside the barometer that measures the weight of air for the barometric pressure. And I don't know. I thought maybe it was perhaps because I mounted in the kitchen where it can be exposed to more smoke and humidity and gunk up that diaphragm. Or could it be just the fact that aneroids don't last long?
I don't think it's because you're in the kitchen, because, I mean, I have my weather station out on the dock, on our dock, and boy, it gets fog and smoke and everything out there. And the one thing that really seems to be solid is the pressure, the pressure gauge.
So what kind of gauge do you have?
You know, I'm running through my head what the brand name is, and I can't remember what it was because it's lasted so long.
Yeah, I don't know if it's Tempest. I just got one by Tempest as a gift.
Tempest.
I haven't mounted it yet. I've heard good things about it. And then the other company I know makes really good meteorological instruments is Vaisala. They tend to be on the expensive side, but I don't know if that's what yours is.
Yeah, no, the Vaisala is too expensive for the dock. I already took one out with a boat once.
Oh, did you? you don't want to do that. You feel pretty bad about that. But they are really high-quality instruments.
Yeah.
And I don't know about lifetimes, but I bet probably longer than 2 years, yeah.
But
yeah.
That diaphragm, is that something that Ed was talking about?
It's
diaphragm
pretty standard technique.
It's pretty standard in everyone?
Yeah.
Device silo, or the other way to do it was with a column of mercury.
That's
you don't want to go that route
takes
these
a lot
days.
Of space. Yeah.
And mercury.
Yeah, you don't want mercury in your house. But but I think Steve's point's good. I don't think that you probably have to worry too much about the humidity or any other pollution in your kitchen. You know, getting piling up on that. It's probably not the factor.
LaCrosse, that's the brand.
LaCrosse is a good one too. Yeah, and they're kind of medium price, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're good. Yeah. They're also good.
So maybe consider LaCrosse, Ed.
Yeah, right.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Vern.
Yeah. So I calculated a great snowstorm of 1993 called the Storm of the Century. And I got it notarized. I got a big poster here. I call it the Core Coal Disaster. It's actually notarized like in January 1993.
You remember that 93 storm? Vern's in Boyd, Wisconsin.
Oh, and it snowed in Boyd. Yeah. I don't think I remember that here in Madison, no. Oh, I wasn't here. It was the year before I came here. So
wasn't that the storm of the century?
That March of 93 was. The one that got 12 inches of snow in Birmingham and places like that.
Right.
More like the one that I think the other caller was talking about, the Gulf Shores or snow. So I don't know about this one from January of 93. Sorry, I don't know much about that one.
Yeah.
Or maybe Vern had the month wrong, too. It's been a long time ago.
It has been January or March.
Right. Yeah. It might have been the March one, Vern. Rich in La Crescent, your turn. Hi, Rich.
Yeah, I have a question about the wildfire smoke that we had this summer, which is almost every other day.
Mm.
Did it have the effect of making the air hotter because there was more things to absorb the heat, or did it make the air cooler because it reflected the sun's heat?
I'm not in the guessing.
It's a really good question.
Yeah,
as you're saying, during the day, it's going to reflect sunlight out, and that's going to tend to keep things cooler. It still has to be pretty dense, though, in order to have that cooling impact. During the night, you would think it would be like a cloud and keep temperatures warmer as it absorbs infrared radiation. But I don't think smoke particles are really as sensitive to the infrared radiation, for example, as clouds.
Mm.
So I don't think it has much of an impact on the nighttime temperature.
Yeah, and I know there's something in the climate science world that's one of the big puzzles known as the aerosol indirect effect. And does that involve how aerosols might seed clouds, clouds? Yeah. So the smoke particles probably have some ability to do that and enhance cloudiness a little bit and maybe undetectable to the naked eye, and in which case they become more radiatively important. But it's a really good question, and it gives an example of how it's difficult sometimes to know how will one phenomena impact the broad scale picture of your meteorology or your climate. There's a lot of different dimensions to most of these high-profile changes in the composition.
And I'm thinking the satellite imagery of those Canadian fire and the smoke that came down here were fantastic.
Yeah, it was amazing. It's right.
It looked like, you know, my parents used to smoke.
Yeah.
It looked like that blue cigarette smoke.
It was so
thick.
Yeah, amazing. You know? And I think this was the second worst Canadian wildfire year ever, and the worst one was 2024. So
yeah, right.
We had them back-to-back.
Yeah.
So incredible.
Rich, thank you again for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email a question or maybe a weather photo. We always love those. To talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with the Weather Guys for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk climate and weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from UW-Madison. Great to have them with us again today. A big thanks to everybody who donated during our fall member drive as well. Support from people like, Helen in Beloit or Rita in Madison make our service possible. And if you missed the member drive, still time to join in with your gift. Just go to WPR.org and you can make a contribution. It's been very uplifting for us here to see the support we've been getting. And I want to thank you so much for helping us keep WPR strong together. A big thanks to everybody who contribute, and you could still do it if you haven't done it already, WPR.org. We have Judy in Evansville emailed to ask, does the warm weather this fall, even at nighttime, have an effect on leaves turning color? Judy thought that a contrast in temperatures between day and night was needed to get good color, and I think that's the case.
Yeah. I think that is the case. If you want that nice color, you want those day-night temperature differences, which usually means you want nice, I always think of it as nice, clear skies during the daytime, because that means it'll be clear during night and it'll cool down.
And you got to have low dew points.
And you got to have low dew points, and you got to have low winds in order not to blow them off.
Yeah, and the low dew point pot has only recently invaded, because last week was hot and muggy. And this week's warm, but not so muggy.
But it doesn't seem like much is turning either down here in
that's
southern
true. Yeah, Wisconsin. We seem behind.
Yeah.
Remember earlier we were talking about something we thought was isotropic inversion, but Charlie, who had asked that question, emailed back to say the phenomena they were talking about is called tropospheric ducting.
And so it's a feature in the atmosphere usually associated with temperature differences. And so that waves just kind of stay in there, like that layer in the atmosphere is a duct, and it just keeps it focused in there.
Yeah, and the troposphere extends from the ground to about 10 kilometers. So it's not very deep. It's approximate to the surface. So that's really nice to know where it is kind of happening.
Yeah. And I was thinking about that remembering that there are times... when I was a kid, I used to listen. There was a Texas a radio station in Texas I could get.
Oh, right, yeah.
On some occasions, and once in a while, driving in the car in the early morning hours, I would be able to draw in St. Louis or some other city. It was always fun to kind of listen to them, what they were talking about.
Yeah.
So tropospheric ducting. Deb emailed to ask if there is a scientific explanation why dogs feel storms coming. And other animals, to be honest, other animals, cattle and so forth, will respond when there's a storm on the way.
I would think it would be associated with either, I was going to say good hearing, but that's probably not it anymore.
That's what I was going to say.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah,
or
maybe
pressure
changes. Dogs have longer snouts, so maybe the pressure is a little bit more noticeable for them. We don't have any snout at all. But they have these long, long snouts that might react to the pressure disturbances that are in the environment when you have thunderstorms going on. Possible.
Or hearing the sound,
yeah,
the frequency
it was
of lightning or something.
And I was thinking of someone who's done a lot of fishing in his life that oftentimes ahead of a storm, a storm is coming, and the fish, muskies at least, I would have better action just ahead of a storm, and even sometimes during a storm, and right after, nothing.
Yeah, I wonder what that's all about. That's interesting.
It's got to be a pressure.
There is a big pressure change when in that sequence, the pressure is lowering as the storm comes by, probably at its lowest when it's over you, and then higher. That might be the thing for that, but I don't know about dogs. That's interesting. Yeah.
And I don't care how good the fishing is. If there's thunder, there's lightning, and you shouldn't be on the lake.
Yeah, that's right.
And Dean in Evergreen, Colorado, emailed back. He had been on earlier, but he had a comment about losing radio signals. Dean's a ham radio operator. Yeah. The FM signal is transmitted directly, almost line of sight, and not bounced off the ionosphere. Hmm. If the person lost the WPR station, it could be due to local interference. That's a typical scenario when receiving radio is marginally receiving the signal from the station to begin with.
Okay. That's good to know.
Which is good. And thanks, Dean, for sending that email in. And you could call in or send an email. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. You wrote in your column, the weather guy's column that appears in the Wisconsin State Journal, which I always read. You wrote a couple of weeks ago a column about what does the Center for Disease Control have to do with the National Weather Service? And to talk about what that column was about.
Well, we were thinking, that the CDC's been under attack. Its scientific expertise has been under attack by, frankly, conspiracy theorists. And it's not that much of a leap to start imagining a National Weather Service that's being, you know, staffed by people who forecasting the weather for you and giving you important information who are also conspiracy theorists, chemtrails or whatever it might be. If we let this go too far, this erosion of expertise and this lack of reliance on experts, we'll put ourselves in some really bad spots. And so we were trying to draw some parallel to that so that people don't lose sight of the fact that an assault on any intellectual expertise is an assault on all intellectual expertise with bad consequences for taxpaying, hardworking Americans. There's no reason for it.
Well stated.
Thanks.
And people have always questioned the accuracy of weather forecasts. Is public doubt in the National Weather Service really a new issue?
I don't think so. I think they're always going to want to see a particular weather, and you're not going to remember necessarily all the accurate well forecasts that were done. You're going to remember that one where, you know, your child was having a wedding ceremony.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
It was supposed to be nice. So there's always those human biases that come in. But that's a lot different than conspiracy theories. I mean, there's no evidence of chemtrails. I mean,
right.
They just, that's not what they are.
Right.
And we're not doing that intentionally to change the climate. And so there's a difference between disagreement on the scientific outcome of a forecast versus something that's just nonsensical.
Yeah, and it's interesting along these lines, you know, the congressional delegations from all of the states in the South that experience more larger fraction of tornadoes, certainly the largest fraction of hurricanes, they're not anti-weather service. They are not anti-weather service. And so the Weather Service is a well-respected scientific institution. I think we were just kind of saying we have to be careful not to let the tide come in on that skepticism, because it'll be really bad news. And we already have at least some people who are elected officials letting ridiculous statements go without challenging them. How much farther can we push that is the question. We got to be careful.
And our weather forecasting has been improving.
Yeah.
I mean,
the
accuracy of a 5-day forecast is, what, a week? Several years ago?
Yeah.
So it's improving.
It always will.
Provided we have the observations and the scientific expertise and the computer infrastructure to do those simulations.
Yeah, that's right. It keeps getting better. This is an enterprise that never takes a step back.
Yeah.
And, you know, it'd be foolish to start to implement changes that would force a step back. We got to be careful of that.
Yeah. You mentioned tornadoes just in passing, and it reminded me that we had a very active tornado season in Wisconsin this year. I think it might have been the sixth highest.
The sixth highest?
Since 1950.
Wow, really? That could be. You know,
we had 39 confirmed.
Oh, so that's almost twice what we typically
get. Yeah, that's amazing. That number sounds familiar from the state climatologist update we got a couple of weeks ago, but I didn't remember the ranking, so that's probably right on target.
So
amazing.
And that's a 75-year span, and the sixth highest. And I think we had one day, July 16th, I think we had four pretty good ones. All on the same day.
Yeah, right. Wow, that's amazing. And probably, was it the northern part of the state that had them more frequently than the southern part? I think that was convective activity was up there a little bit more frequently than down here. Wow.
And there was also the tornado alleys have moved a little bit as well, so that, I mean, everything east of the Rockies, it's now kind of a tornado alley, and to me it seems as though we're seeing many more tornadoes in the south than, you know, along the east coast even than we had before. Maybe not, but...
Well, you're right about that the tornado alley moving slightly east from what it was in the 50s to the 80s. Victor Gensini down at Northern Illinois University has done work on that, and they've definitely shown that it's moved a little bit to the east. So that's absolutely observed phenomena, and probably increases the risk for a larger population of people to being visited by a tornado.
Do they have a theory of why it's moving?
I can't remember what they say. It's Gensini and Harold Brooks from the Storm Prediction Center in Oklahoma. A really nice study. I forget what they said about that. It wasn't so much that the intensity was changing or the total number. It was just that the locations
were moving.
Yeah.
Locations and not were more observers.
It probably would have been the headlining thing, which I don't recall. I don't want to say no, but I don't think it was
that. Yeah, would have been the headlining thing,
And what about Haboobs?
Haboobs are dust storms. We had one in we have a couple, I think, not in Wisconsin, but in the southeast Arizona, and there was one this summer.
Yeah.
They're pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's a big dust storm. I mean, if you've seen a picture of a dust storm coming at a city, that's probably a haboob, usually associated with outflow from a thunderstorm or something. I was in one like that in Saudi Arabia many, many years ago.
Oh, is that right?
It's like somebody throwing sand at you for 20 minutes. I mean, it's just
an electrical shock danger, isn't there?
Yeah, but you're worried about the
probably
the sand
else.
Particles.
Yeah.
You know, tearing the skin off your face as opposed to the electric. But you're right; there is static electricity, as there would be with almost anything moving like that.
Wow, that's amazing.
So you need Wisconsin doesn't have the same kind of.
No, we have the same storms, but you need a surface that's devegetated. And
dry.
Farm fields like that, they're probably not going to be dry, or they're not going to be big enough.
Also,
they don't grind. I mean, when they till a farm field now, you got big clumps of soil in there. It's not like back in the 20s, they used to grind that up even smaller. But part of the reason of not doing that was the Dust Bowl. We learned that's not a good thing to do when you till a field.
Yeah, amazing.
And Gene wonders, what causes lightning?
Static electricity in the storm. So it's when you have a thunderstorm, that's where they occur. You're going to have liquid water droplets and ice crystals. And it's sort of like, I know it's a very simple analogy, but that rubber balloon on the wool sweater generates electric charge. And so as the water droplets interact and brush by the ice particles, you end up getting charge within the storm, so that the charge separation occurs in the thunderstorm, and then the lightning is an attempt to neutralize that.
And what's the length? Also wants to know, what's the length of a lightning bolt?
That was just validated.
We just read in the
news. 515 miles long.
That's unbelievable.
And it occurred in 2017. So that's how long it took to validate what it was. And that was by the World Meteorological Organization, I think, the validations. But
it's, do you remember where it was? I forget where it happened.
No, I don't.
I thought
remember.
It was in the U.S.
It was in the U.S., but
I don't
remember. Yeah, it was in the Midwest someplace. Not
Is that what they call a mega flash?
That's what they call a mega flash, And, you know, now that we have improved observations for lightning, both on the ground but in space as well now, they've been able to identify these really big, long lightning
That's
events,
horrifying. Talk about action at a distance. Are
right?
you kidding me?
550 miles away.
How'd you like to be on the receiving end of that bolt?
No, and, you know, that's one of the safety issues. If you hear thunder roar, go indoors, even if it's blue sky out.
Yeah.
Because those lightning bolts can come out of the top.
They don't care.
And come down.
So they can happen. You can have blue sky above and get
and
struck
a thunderstorm
by lightning.
Nearby and get hit by lightning.
Well, on that happy note,
that's
shocking.
But it's not thundering outside, so we're okay.
Oh, guys, thanks again for me. We'll see you the last Monday of October.
All right,
looking forward to talking about how the colors in Wisconsin were beautiful.
I hope so. Steve Ackerman, a former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison, one of our guests today, and John Martin, of course, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, our weather guys. And they'll be back the last Monday of the month. They do it every month of the year. And thank you for listening today. These and all of our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks again for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.